Yeah.
I know whenever I go to parties and people ask me, you know, what you do, and I say I'm an economist, I say, well, what do you study? I say productivity, and they usually walk off at that point.
Yeah, well, I can identify with that.
If I then say, well, I actually, my measure of productivity is, you know, whether you stay alive, then that really gets people interested.
Huh, that is interesting. Let's find out more, shall we? Today, on Freakonomics Radio, we will look at productivity in a whole new light, from the good.
He estimates that you can make a house in about 24 hours.
To the bad.
We've been working on it for over 50 years, and we still haven't managed to make it power a toaster.
To the ugly.
So we might destroy our species as we know it while chasing total factor productivity.
Wait a minute. What does powering a toaster and building a house in 24 hours have to do with destroying our species? What ties all these together?
The only way to tie these together is it's just getting harder and harder to find new ideas.
This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Let's start with the power of an idea.
I am a believer in the power of ideas, and the kind of ideas that I really cherish are those ideas that are incredibly simple.
That's my Freakonomics friend and co-author Steve Levitt. He's an economist at the University of Chicago.
I've really come to think that many companies that are successful are really successful on the back of one or two simple ideas. I often get the feeling that they believe they're good at everything, when the evidence is probably that they're about average at everything except for one or two things that they happen to be really good at.
If ideas are so powerful, and if all it takes is one or two great ideas to make a company successful, you'd think that everyone would spend a lot of time searching for great ideas. That's not what Levitt sees.
I am a believer that, in general, people spend far too little time devoted to trying to come up with ideas, and far too much time, in contrast, you know, executing on, you know, day-to-day things that, you know, could be transformed through the power of ideas.
Levitt's idea about ideas is really just an idea, but what if we upgraded it to a hypothesis? Could this hypothesis then be tested?
The power of ideas makes it something which is very different from many other goods.
That's John Van Reenen, an economist at MIT.
Well, thanks for having me.
And Nicholas Bloom is an economist at Stanford.
Hi, Stephen. Good to hear from you.
Bloom and Van Reenen, along with two more economists, Charles Jones and Michael Webb, have written a paper with a deliciously provocative title. It's called Are Ideas Getting Harder to Find? It begins with the assumption that ideas are, indeed, extraordinarily powerful, that a good idea can create exponential leverage.
So, you know, it took a long time for the first person to come up with the invention of the wheel, but once that was discovered, lots of other people could start using that information to make wheels. New ideas can spread very easily and can actually drive the forces of productivity growth.
Economists see a natural connection between an idea and productivity and the growth thereof. And for economists, productivity growth is a really big deal. It's what keeps pushing our standards of living higher, which means it's a big deal for the rest of us. It's incorporated into all our economic models, like the ones that tell governments and firms how much money to set aside for future budgets and pensions and healthcare costs. If you base your calculations on a certain growth rate, and then the growth rate falls, well, that's a problem. For many decades, our economy grew at a robust and fairly predictable rate. The computer revolution and all its bounty seemed to suggest more of the same. We spoke about this with the economist Robert Gordon in an earlier episode. It was called, Yes, the American Economy is in a Funk, but not for the reasons you think.
Yes, during the heyday of the dot-com revolution, we had our nationwide measures of progress, namely productivity growth, catching up briefly for about a decade to the kinds of measures of progress that we had back in the second industrial revolution. So it was transformative, but it didn't last long. The revival of productivity growth occurred only between about 1995 and 2005.
And what about lately? Nick Bloom again.
The most recent few years in the U.S. and globally have been so dismal and so depressing, we start to think, well, is this part of a longer trend?
But what about all these amazing new technologies?
You know, living in Silicon Valley, I definitely, you know, drink the Kool-Aid and get very, very excited about the technology.
But, you know, there's a but coming, right?
But it just seems when you add up all the numbers, there just aren't enough new technologies to offset the decline.
How can that be? We're being bombarded by new technologies. And even more persuasive, there's the standard growth models used by economists.
The standard model says, well, as long as you can keep that number of researchers researching and, you know, coming up with the new ideas, the kind of self-driving cars, the new drugs, the new technologies, we'll continue to have those rates of growth. But that's always been a bit weird to me in a sense, because, you know, with most activities in life, you get diminishing returns. You know, you get more out from everything you put in, but the amount you get out slows down at a certain point.
Can I just say, I'm so glad to hear you say exactly what you just said, because, I mean, you've expressed my layperson's view of, you know, I guess what you call endogenous growth theory, and you expressed it much better than I ever could. But, you know, in this paper, you write here, I'll quote you to yourself, a key assumption of many endogenous growth models is that a constant number of researchers can generate constant exponential growth. And to me, as a non-economist, that just sounds absurd. I mean, your profession is the one that invented the phrase diminishing returns. So why on earth should the assumption be that growth is not only constant, but exponential?
Yeah, I mean, I think to give, you know, endogenous growth, you know, theory, it's due. I mean, you know, before then, the idea, economists always thought, you know, technology is critical for growth. But the assumption was that kind of that technology kind of dropped on us like manna from heaven. It was kind of exogenous. It was just going to continue. So actually trying to incorporate the choice of doing research and development to create innovations, I think, is a very strong part of endogenous growth theory. So that part I like, where I think this kind of this other assumption, as you said, sounds a bit, you know, that's going to go on forever with a fixed number of inputs isn't something which I think is so compelling.
That's the relationship that Van Rienen, Bloom, and their colleagues set out to explore, the relationship between growth and technology, including where the ideas for new technologies come from. Their paper includes three primary case studies. The first deals with the computer industry and what's known as Moore's Law.
Moore's Law goes back to an observation made by Gordon Moore, who was one of the co-founders of Intel, way back in 1965, and he noticed that the number of transistors per square inch on a circuit doubled roughly every other year.
And that's led to something like every year, 35% improvements of productivity in semiconductors. So enormous rates of improvements of, you know, technological progress in that sector, driving the kind of digital revolution, the computer revolution. So people often point to this. So what we do is you say, okay, that's great, but to get that 35% improvement every year, how much research and development had to go into doing that. And what we show is the amount of research going into semiconductors has enormously increased, but productivity growth in that sector hasn't accelerated.
So back in 1965, there are a few teams around the country working on this. Now, there's hundreds and hundreds of millions, billions globally spent on trying to improve the speed of silicon chips. And as a result, we calculate the amount of resources has gone up by 25-fold. So we've had a 25-fold increase in inputs just to maintain the same speed.
It's so interesting because Moore's Law is held up as kind of the banner for human progress and the amazing gains that technology has to offer. And you're saying, yeah, that benefit is real, but the costs have just been totally overlooked, at least by people outside the industry, yeah?
Yeah, so it's become harder and harder. They do spend more and more money.
The second case study, agricultural productivity.
So agriculture is another nice sector to look at because you can look at crop yields produced per kind of acre of land.
Yeah, so productivity in agriculture has been declining for a long time. There was a huge, you know, a burst of productivity growth between the 30s and the 60s with modern hybrid seeds, with better fertilizer, with better farm management. But most of those gains have been eked out. American farmers, in fact, are incredibly efficient and businesslike. And as a result now, it's kind of on, you know, third down in the 4-yard line. It's really grinding out yardage with, you know, incredible pain.
Just like in semiconductors, you see that the amount of R&D which has gone in has been very large in order to maintain more or less the same rate of growth.
Okay, so you've looked at semiconductors, you've looked at agriculture. I think a lot of people, even if they don't deal in economics at all, can relate to the idea of productivity growth in those fields. But the next one is a little bit different: mortality and life expectancy. Talk about what you were looking for there, what the data were, and what you found.
So we look at how different type of treatments have improved people's life expectancy. So treatments towards breast cancer or other forms of cancer, to what extent has research there helped improve people's length of life and the kind of quality of life that they live?
Yeah, so mortality and life expectancy, you know, the numbers there are a great example of the offsetting forces. We looked at the cost to increase a human life year. And in fact, you see over most of the time that's been increasing, but there was actually a surge in productivity in the late 80s and 90s. And that was part of the era of modern professionalization of drug discovery. So pharmaceutical firms got very effective at mass screening of, you know, thousands of compounds in a more automated way. And of course, that made them more productive. We could again see something going forwards with genetic medicine. So, you know, this depressing downward trend isn't universal, certainly not by fields. You know, it's more of a roller coaster.
I mean, there have been these, you know, phenomenal improvements in survival rates after cancers and other kinds of diseases. But in order to get those, again, we've had to put in huge amounts of resources in terms of research and development, and those have increased by very large orders, and it hasn't improved at the accelerating rate that you'd expect given the amount of research dollars which have gone into it.
In addition to the case studies in the medical, agricultural, and computer industries, the researchers also used the CompuStat database to examine firm-level data across all sorts of industries.
Yeah, so we also looked at, you know, thousands of firms publicly listed in the U.S., and we looked at how much they spent on R&D and how that translated into gains in sales, gains in employment, and gains in market capitalizations. And in all cases, you know, there's a positive relationship. The more you spend, generally, the more you sell and the more valuable you are. But that relationship has been falling over time. So, you know, for $1 million of R&D in the 60s, you got something like three times as much impact in terms of sales as you would in the 80s. And again, it's been falling ever since. You know, the low-hanging fruit is all gone and it's becoming far harder.
Between the R&D story, the case studies, and the fact that productivity growth is slowing in the economy as a whole, Van Rienen and Bloom think the data show a clear picture.
Growth is slowing down at the same time as we're spending ever more money on research and development. So what that tells us is it's just taking more and more dollars of R&D to increase growth or to increase output, so to keep growth at a reasonable rate. And the only way to tie these together is it's just getting harder and harder to find new ideas.
As our knowledge grows greater and greater, getting the next increments of knowledge, the next idea, becomes more challenging.
Think of some of the most important innovations that have happened, things like penicillin. So Alexander Fleming, he basically discovered it on his own, or flight, the Wright brothers. They more or less invented, you know, the modern aircraft, or the electric light. Thomas Edison in the US and Charles Swan in the UK independently basically came up with modern lights. They were massive inventions that came about from, you know, one or two people more or less tinkering around in their own labs. So, you know, I visited a LED factory the other day, and the LED factory for modern light bulbs looks like something out of the Terminator movie with, you know, machines and robots everywhere. But they also told me they've spent, you know, hundreds of millions in R&D. So in every case, you know, huge inventions that have changed the world seem to, in history, come from one or two individuals. And now it's taking huge corporations, you know, universities and the government, hundreds or typically billions of dollars to push it ahead.
Again, this is not what economists had been predicting. Economists had predicted that new technologies would continue to push growth forward.
So the basic assumptions in these models that a given number of scientists or expenditure in R&D would deliver a fixed amount of growth is just wrong.
So how upset should we be at the economics profession?
Ooh, should we be upset? Of course we shouldn't be upset with the economics profession. I mean, in this case, it's, you know, don't shoot the messenger. We're kind of delivering some hard truths. I mean, sure, of course, fair enough. You know, I think in Greek legend, the messenger got shot. I think it was the crow. But, you know, in this case, I'm hoping I don't get shot.
Coming up after the break, what if these economists who are saying the other economists were wrong, what if they're the ones who are wrong? In other words, what if there are a lot of new ideas in the pipeline that might create a productivity explosion?
If you improve people's IQs, they tend to become not just more productive, but, you know, happier, more social, less likely to commit crimes, that sort of thing.
And we've all been told about the need for continuing economic growth, but...
But, you know, why are we so obsessed with growth?
That's coming up right after this.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing tools designed to enable customers to bundle home and auto insurance. More information available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So a bunch of economists have recently concluded that a bunch of other economists, the entire economics profession, really, has historically been kind of wrong about economic growth, that growth has slowed in large part because there just aren't as many good ideas.
You know, the low-hanging fruit is all gone and it's becoming far harder.
And these economists have assembled a mountain of data to make this argument. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're right either. Let me introduce you to a couple of people who offer a different view. Warning, they are not economists.
So my training is as a parasitologist.
That's Kelly Wiener-Smith.
I study parasites that manipulate the behavior of their hosts at Rice University.
I draw a comic called Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal.
And that is Zach Wiener-Smith.
And I run a show called The Festival of Bad Ad Hoc Hypotheses.
The Wiener-Smiths are a married couple, and they've written a book together called Soonish, 10 Emerging Technologies That'll Improve and or Ruin Everything.
This is the first time we've sort of formally worked together on something big.
It was definitely stressful, but that was because he had a full-time job as a cartoonist, I had a full-time job at Rice University, and I was pregnant and we had a two-year-old. So it was nuts, but it was a good time.
Soonish begins with some welcome sarcasm. Quote, "This is one of those books where we predict the future. Fortunately, predicting the future is pretty easy."
So it's really hard to make these kinds of predictions. And just about, you know, all the data suggests that the people who make these predictions are often wildly wrong. They almost always still have jobs, which is good for those people.
The first emerging technology the Wiener-Smiths look at is space travel. It currently costs somewhere around $10,000 per pound to escape Earth's gravity, which is a lot. But reusable rockets from companies like SpaceX and Virgin Galactic could change that.
Well, if you can bring that cost way down, then you can imagine that it would be much cheaper to launch satellites, for example. And if you launch satellites, then our communication systems are going to get better. They're going to get cheaper.
In terms of, you know, going to other planets, it's not clear to me how you get rich other than having tourists. And that's awesome, and I'm all for it. But as far as I know, it doesn't boost productivity. I don't know, maybe people go to Mars and they come back with some sort of better sense of self and they become more productive, but I doubt it. So beyond tourism, the economic applications of space are pretty questionable.
Okay, let's say space travel is not the productivity game changer we're looking for. How about another hot technology, fusion energy? The Wiener-Smiths are kind of cool on this one, too.
Because we've been working on it for over 50 years, and we still haven't managed to make it something that we can use to, for example, power a toaster.
Okay, but here's an idea they're bullish on. Biotechnologies. Bioprinting, for instance.
So the idea here is that you harvest cells from an individual who has an organ that's failing. You grow up those cells in large numbers, and then you put them through a 3D printer that builds you a new organ layer by layer.
Also, synthetic biology.
A big exciting thing is you can create organisms that make complex molecules that we like, such as medicines or fuels.
And precision medicine.
So the idea with precision medicine is that if we know enough about you in particular, we can figure out the best treatment for exactly the disease that you have and the best treatment for you in particular.
We could also, using the CRISPR gene editing tool, address entire diseases in the gene pool. We looked at this possibility in an earlier episode called Evolution Accelerated. And then there's the idea that brain-computer interfaces could jack up our cognitive abilities, which might have a lot of positive externalities.
And so there's pretty robust evidence that if you improve people's IQs, they tend to become not just more productive, but you know, happier, more social, less likely to commit crimes, that sort of thing. So that seems like a good benefit.
So at the moment, these devices are being used for things like trying to give amputees the ability to move their arms again or to move their fingers again. But it's possible that at some point, many of us will have devices on our brain that help us be a little bit more efficient.
The ominous thing there is, and this is already happening with pharmaceuticals, is once one person is using, everybody else in the industry is going to feel the obligation to use. So there's this weird thing where we might destroy our species as we know it while chasing total factor productivity. So my opinions are largely negative on that. But to an economist, that might seem great.
One of the most promising technologies to boost productivity? Augmented reality.
So the idea with augmented reality is through your augmented reality glasses or through the iPhone or iPad that you're looking through.
And maybe in the future that's a contact lens or something.
You're looking at the real world, and layered on top of the real world are things that don't really exist there.
And so there are obviously entertainment applications for this, but from an economic perspective, there's a lot of amazing stuff. So one, you could drastically cut down training time.
There's companies who are integrating augmented reality into construction helmets. And the task that the people did was done with fewer errors the very first time when they were wearing these helmets.
It's not just that you can do it because you have the system set up. You actually learn how to do it faster. So the economic benefit of that could be huge, especially right now when some people argue there's a skills mismatch. So if you can fix that skills mismatch without having to have people go to 2 years of training, if you can cut it down to a year or 6 months, that's potentially really huge.
So in general, it could make our workforce more efficient, more likely to catch errors before they happen, and it could make training happen much more quickly.
Another almost ready for primetime technology, robotic construction.
If you look around your office, mostly you're going to see things that were cheaply manufactured in mass manufacturing systems. And that's why they're relatively inexpensive compared to what it would have cost to hand make them. Buildings are essentially handmade.
Yeah, so robotic construction is an area that I'm particularly really excited about. And so one of the robots that we came across was a robot called Sam, or the semi-automated mason. And Sam is a robot that's able to lay bricks.
It slaps mortar down, sticks a brick on, and just keeps rolling, and does it very quickly.
And Sam, coupled with a person, is able to work 3 times faster than one person alone. And so you can imagine that could have really major impacts on home building. And there are a number of other technologies that we came across. For example, a technology called contour crafting, which is made by Dr. Baruch Kashnevitz at the University of Southern California. And what this is essentially a giant gantry, so like an upside-down U, that has a 3D printer attached to it that uses a special kind of concrete, and it makes the outside of the house. And it also has an arm, so as the house is being built, it sticks pipes in and stuff as it goes. So the only thing you have to do at the end of the day is stick the windows and the door in when you're finished printing out the rest of the house. And you can make a house in about 24 hours, and I believe it was for something like $5,000. So pretty cheap and super fast relative to how long it takes to make and build a house now.
So there are all sorts of exciting possibilities, and I think it's pretty obvious how that would improve productivity. You're either going to make individual construction workers a whole lot more productive on the job, or perhaps a bit more ominously, you might just replace them entirely, which obviously on paper economically makes the average worker more productive, though it would displace a lot of people, and how that would shake out is questionable, especially in the short term.
How all this shakes out is a big question, big set of questions, really. It's something we've looked into before on this show in past episodes like how safe is your job and is the world ready for a guaranteed basic income? Because if machines can do most of our work better, faster, cheaper, and more safely, how does that change the shape of a society that's built around human labor? Here's what the MIT economist Erik Brynjolfsson told us earlier.
We're now beginning to have machines be able to augment and automate our brains and replace mental tasks. Machines can do computations and make decisions. And we're still in the early stages of this, but we believe that the implications will be at least as profound as what the Industrial Revolution did for our muscles.
This, of course, raises even more questions. What do we do with all the time we used to spend working? If we're not being paid to work, where will our money come from? And will those machines and robots eventually conclude that we humans aren't worth having around?
It brings to mind Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey and the rebellious computer robot HAL. Technologically speaking, we are just about there.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
A lot of technologists and economists see a huge upside in the spread of artificial intelligence, and they say that upside will show up in the productivity numbers before long. Others are more pessimistic. One reason for pessimism? Good ideas are getting harder and harder to find. That, at least, is the theory put forth by Nick Bloom and John Van Reenen. I asked Bloom which camp he puts himself in, techno-optimist or techno-pessimist.
Ooh, good question. I'm going to claim I'm a techno-realist. But if that has to put me in one of those two camps, I guess a techno-pessimist. You know, if you claim the optimists see a future where everything's fantastic and growth explodes, I just don't see that happening. Look back over the last 40, 50 years, extrapolate out, and growth continues, but, you know, there's no nirvana over the rainbow. It's certainly not Clockwork Orange or WALL-E, these kind of depressing futuristic technologies, but... And I see more of the same, which is, you know, slow growth eked out by millions of scientists and engineers around the world working away in labs. We're not saying growth's going to stop. It's just getting more and more expensive. But, you know, why are we so obsessed with growth?
Yeah, I mean, you've basically just summarized my view, which is that, I mean, twofold. A, why are we, and by we, I mean you, economists, so obsessed with growth? Because I think that's where we, the populace, gets this idea from, which is that economists have been preaching for the past, I don't know, 50, 80 years, that growth is kind of the natural, necessary state of the body economic, and that if it doesn't proceed apace, then we're in a lot of trouble, and there's a lot of malaise associated with 1 or 2% growth. So why are we so obsessed with growth?
Well, we like growth because growth enables us to spend more money on things that we like. So schools, hospitals, cars, you know, nice meals out. But on the other hand, there's no necessary level of growth. If you look back at humanity from about the Roman Empire to something like 1800, there was almost no growth. So there's kind of 2,000 years of which growth was, people estimate, about 0.1%. It then exploded to 1% during the Industrial Revolution. If you think of what's happening now, we're something like, you know, 2%. So compared to most of the history of humankind, we have actually incredibly high growth rates now and should be very thankful.
Yeah, so why aren't we? Other than the fact that we had what may turn out to have been a temporary golden era of absurdly high growth.
I think our expectations have been normed by, 40, 50 years of fantastic growth since World War II. So, it's like take a very rich man and make him rich. He feels poor. Much like, you know, we've had 3, 4% growth since World War II. We've now, inverted commas, plummeted to 2% growth. But again, if you look back to, you know, our great-grandparents would have been incredibly happy with 2% growth since that was faster than anything they'd ever seen before in their time and, you know, generations back over the history of humankind.
John Van Reenen agrees that we should appreciate the dramatic growth of the past, but he also recognizes the limits of that appreciation.
People seem extremely angry that the growth rates that they got used to over the last 50 years don't seem to be happening. My impression is that most people are not at all comfortable with that, that they have come to expect that, you know, they'll be better off than the parents were. And the fact that seems not to be happening is something which I think is creating a lot of political and social unrest all over the West at the moment.
So if we can agree that more growth is better than less growth, and if we can agree that good ideas are both A, necessary for better growth, and B, increasingly harder to find, what's to be done about it?
I think the people that should be listening to this seriously is our politicians, because the thing that worries me most is our pensions and budget deficits are all based on, frankly, unrealistic growth numbers. So the way it works is you go to Washington, they look back at growth over the last 20, 30 years and say, hey, presto, this is what we're going to get over the next 20, 30 years. So we can now spend a lot of money and pay it back later. But if unfortunately the US economy doesn't grow like that, we'll discover when we all come to retire, there's nothing left in the pension pot and actually we're facing massive tax bills.
Right. So if you were the politician, you would say, look, here's the sad truth is that productivity is a lot more expensive to come by now, or growth is more expensive to come by now. And if we want to keep having it, we have to take money from elsewhere and put it here. Is that essentially a sort of policy-ish prescription you would advise?
If I was an honest politician, I would, you know, face up to the fact growth is slowing down. You know, you have to be realistic. If I was a politician fighting for political survival, you know, I may be tempted to fudge it a bit and kind of ignore the issue.
All right. So let's pretend you are, however, an honest politician or an advisor to an honest politician. What kind of policy prescriptions would you make based on your findings in this paper, Nick?
I would spend more on research and development. So
yeah,
we can have higher growth with more R&D. So the ways to do that was obviously make it more tax advantageous for firms, so a more generous R&D tax credit. More government funding, you know, this is why it seems like an insider job, but honestly, more government funding to research in universities, science and engineering, more government labs. So yeah, what you see in the US is why private firms' R&D expenditure has risen. That tends to be more development, more market-focused research. The more basic R of R&D, the research, the kind of high-level stuff is actually done more in government labs and universities, and the funding for that has actually been cut.
John Van Reenen offers another policy idea drawn from a paper he wrote with several co-authors. It's called The Life Cycle of Inventors. They analyzed data from more than 1.2 million U.S. inventors from 1996 to 2014.
We found many things, but I think one of the most striking things was that if you were born to a family in the top 1% of the income distribution, you were 10 times more likely to grow up to be an inventor than if you were born in the bottom 50% of the income distribution. And one story why that is well, maybe, you know, kids of rich parents are just so much smarter than the kids of poor parents. But we could look at the kind of test scores of what these kids got at a very early age, like in third grade. And we found that the kind of ability in maths and other subjects, although it was higher for the rich kids than the poor kids, wasn't so much difference that it could explain these kind of very large differences in future invention rates. And so what we argued in that paper is that, you know, if you're born into a poor family or if you're in some disadvantaged group, there are, you know, big barriers to you growing up to becoming an inventor. This is a big loss to American society. If you could kind of remove some of those barriers to becoming inventors, you might actually find some lost Einsteins, some people who could really make a huge difference to knowledge and productivity of the economy. One of the ways you might want to improve the rate of invention and the rate of growth is to think about kind of policy interventions to help improve the chances of disadvantaged kids becoming inventors.
So who's right, the techno-optimists or the techno-pessimists? There's one thing we've learned over the years doing this show. It's that predicting the future is a fool's game. But a lot of research suggests that, at the very least, optimism is good for your health. So let's go out with this from Soonish co-author Zach Wienersmith.
The one thing that gives me a little bit of optimism is I think, somewhat famously, in the 19th century physics, there were a lot of people that thought they had reached the point where we were just figuring out the details. Now we basically got it figured out. And then there was Einstein and the quantum revolution. Given the preponderance of people in history who thought we were out of new things, we should at least be a bit reticent to, at the present moment, decide that we're in that situation. I like to say I think it's very important to remember that there's a strong cognitive bias to consider that you are at the end of history, because the history books all end with you. But for any given thing, whether it's increasing human productivity or it's some sort of social or cultural institution, wherever you are right now is probably the middle, not the beginning or end, because the middle is the big part of most things. So I think the optimist in me wants to say that the adventure that was started sometime in the 18th century is probably still continuing. We're probably somewhere in the middle.
Nice. Let's raise a glass to being somewhere in the middle. Coming up after the break, Steve Levitt returns to answer your questions about highway merging, realtors, and the death penalty.
So, yeah, I think the death penalty is purely at this point a political beast and not a crime reduction tool.
That's next, right after this.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Abacus, a real-time expense reporting software designed to reimburse team members, reconcile corporate cards, and implement expense policies without expense reports. More information at abacus.com/freak.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
All right, Levitt. So our first question today is from Jay Jones in Tennessee. Do you think people who use one initial are more typically male or female?
I would say male, but it's hard to tell because they only use one initial. Mm.
All right. Jay Jones from Tennessee writes to say, one of our local four-lane divided highways has been under construction for years. Typically, one of the two northbound lanes is closed. There's a full mile of signs and lights to warn drivers, and cones slowly start to close off the one lane. I think we know where this is going, right? I don't know if it's Southern hospitality or what, but drivers will start merging into the open lane for a mile or more before the other lane closes. It's not uncommon to find the open lane backed up for several miles and the other lane standing empty long before it actually closes. And then, Jay Jones writes, I know the most efficient way is to use the zipper merge, where drivers fill both lanes right up to the merge point and then take turns merging into the single lane. Because I know this is the best way, I typically drive in the unused lane, flying past dozens of cars who look at me as if I'm cheating. Levitt, I believe this behavior is called side zooming. Jay Jones concludes, I am a very friendly and safe driver, and I believe my behavior is helping reduce traffic. If I am correct, why don't more people know about the zipper merge? So Levitt, to me, I don't know if it's so much a question of why don't more people know, but a question of even if people do know, would they still not do it? What do you think?
So let me just divert this question a little bit before we talk about the particulars of what Jay Jones has to say, which is a classic example of where you need a nudge, where it's actually the problem here is the signage is so terrible. So this is a case where people who are trying to do the right thing are doing the wrong thing because they're being told to do something. So just tell them to do something different, which is stay in your lane. Just, you know, all the sign would have to say is stay in your lane. A merge will happen in half a mile. And you'd get the exact same zipper. It would be more efficient. You wouldn't have any open lanes, and nobody would feel bad about themselves. Mm-hmm. So this is actually a perfect example of where public policy, and a very simple public policy, which is just moving around a few signs, could actually resolve the problem and create tremendous amounts of efficiency and also utility, I think, because it's not just inefficient. It's incredibly frustrating when people are doing side zooming.
And what's your personal stance on the morality of side zooming?
I tend not to think of the world in very moral terms. I tend to think of the world in terms of efficiency terms and in terms of prices and whatnot. But I have to say the one place where I exercise some morality is when I'm driving the car. And at some point in my life, I just decided that I wasn't going to be a side zoomer. And it's funny. It's a very tenuous morality because if I'm in a taxi cab and he's side zooming, I'm happy. I'm glad that the onus of the misdeed is not on me. I'd like to get there faster. But I just found it easier for myself, rather than every time I got in a situation to try to make a judgment about whether I should side zoom or not, to simply say, it's not who I am. I'm not a side zoomer. I'm just going to do the right thing.
Yeah, but let me ask you this. According to the Federal Highway Administration, the zipper merge, or what's called late merges in the traffic literature, that they do work, that they cut down a lot on overall congestion. So really, in your urge to be a moral person, in this case, in the side-zooming case, you're actually part of the problem, not the solution. Doesn't that make you reconsider? It doesn't even take a traffic authority or a physicist to know that if you are leaving half a mile of one lane empty, then you're slowing down everything, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing you want to do is, I think, from a public policy perspective, is not put people's identity and their morality in conflict with efficiency.
So getting back to Jay Jones's actual question, if I am correct, he or she wrote, why don't more people know about the zipper merge? So maybe we would change that and say, why don't more people, you know, use that side zooming, use that second lane and do it? What's your overall answer to Jay Jones then for why people don't do it?
I think in his setting, it's socially costly to be zooming past people when you don't want to be that kind of person.
Socially costly because people will maybe shoot you a look or honk their horn at you?
You know, you're taking advantage of other people. You're putting yourself above other people by every car you pass is waiting a few extra seconds because you passed them. And I have to admit, there was a time in my life where I wanted to be the kind of person who did that. It was fun. I got a little bit of joy out of the whipping by on the right lane. But then at some point, I changed.
So if Jay Jones is the kind of person who says, look, I know that I'm doing the right thing for everyone, and it's even more right for me, and he or she is willing to absorb that social cost, you have no problem with it. It's just that that's not who you are.
Yeah, absolutely. I have no real problem with the individual. So I understand when people pursue their own incentives. What I have a problem with is when the structures of society break down and it allows people who are exploiting other people to be able to do that without any punishment.
All right. This is coming from Ryan, who's from Sandy, Utah. Ryan writes to say, my question is, how has the internet not killed the market for realtors yet? As a middleman, realtors connect sellers with buyers because they have access to a huge database, MLS, or multiple listing service. But one thing the internet is best at, making information accessible, has created efficiencies that have decimated other middlemen industries, such as travel agents. So why is it still the norm to pay tens of thousands of dollars per home in commissions to realtors? I've tried to find answers, writes Ryan, but it's extremely hard to find unbiased info. Parenthesis, everyone has a relative who's a real estate agent. So Levitt, before you answer the question, why hasn't the disintermediation of the internet and the digital revolution generally worked on the real estate business? Maybe you could just start by summarizing your research on real estate agents that we wrote about way back in 2005 in Freakonomics.
Sure. A long, long time ago with Chad Severson, I did some research on real estate and the somewhat perverse incentives that real estate agents face could lead them to not give the best possible service to their clients. And in particular, when a real estate agent sells a house, they do take a commission, but by the time that commission is split between the buying and the selling agent and their respective companies, that to the actual pocket of the agent goes only 1%. And so what happens is, since the agent has to do most of the work and actually is responsible for paying many of the fees associated with advertising and whatnot, the agent, in principle, should be really eager to make a sale, even if the sale is not at the highest possible price. And that's just a simple fact of the way the incentives are set up.
So that explains why the incentives of an individual agent may not be aligned with the incentives of a home seller, right? But it looks like the average commission rate nationwide on home sale transactions as of 2013, the latest number I see here, it's still 5.4%. So that's still an awful lot of money to be paying for what a lot of people would argue is a relatively small amount of work. Or I guess an easier way to put it is, if you end up paying $100,000 or $50,000 commission on the sale of an expensive home, if you were to divide that into an hourly rate, your real estate agent for that one sale at least is getting paid an awful lot per hour. So why does this model still predominate?
I'm not exactly sure. I think that the most likely explanation is what an economist would call the two-sided nature of the real estate market, in the sense that there's an agent who represents the buyer and an agent who represents the seller. And so the question is, if I didn't have an agent, could I have gotten a home cheaper? So what I might do as a buyer is I'd say to the seller's agent, hey, you and I both know that if I had my own real estate agent, you would have to give 2.5% to that agent. So how about we work out a deal where out of your own fee, you give me some money, or you bargain harder, you know, with your own client so that you like get me a better deal, or some way I can get some part of that 2.5%.
So that sounds totally sensible. It also sounds like it might put the seller's agent in a slightly illegal position.
So I don't know about legality. I do know that the last time I bought a house, I exactly
did try to go ahead
and say, and you know what was interesting is the seller's agent actually said, you know, I don't want to be caught in some kind of moral bind, so I'm going to have one of my friends serve as your buyer's agent.
Of course you are.
And so
right.
there isn't any worry about a conflict of interest because I want someone representing you.
But that's also giving their friend a big envelope of cash, essentially, right?
I wanted them to give the cash to me, but they wanted to give it to their friend instead. I'll tell you, what I'm surprised by is the way of providing services by realtors that come in the form of a percentage of the house price. That's the thing that to me seems to make less sense, in that agents do all sorts of things that have tremendous potential value to both buyers and sellers. They tell you what your home is worth, how to prepare it. They do advertising. They do open houses. They do negotiating. They, they find clients. They do all sorts of things. They put you on the MLS. And all of those things you could imagine being charged
a la carte.
A la carte, or by the hour.
So, Levitt, here are some Bureau of Labor Statistics data for median pay for real estate agents and brokers in the U.S. It's around $48,000 a year, which is roughly $23 an hour. Let's call it $25. So, theoretically, if you could hire an agent directly for $25 an hour, which is not very much, certainly would pale in comparison to what you pay in overall commission, it'd be win-win because you're going to end up paying a lot less, presumably, I would argue, than you would if you're going for the whole full Monty commission structure.
Yeah, the thing, though, that's left out of that argument is that a very small share of the time that agents are actually spending being real estate agents is actually representing clients. That the overwhelming activity that agents do is trying to find clients. And so, you know, the fact that they get paid $25 an hour, you know, means probably they're getting paid, if only, say, 25% of their time is spent actually working on behalf of clients, they'd have to charge you $100 an hour. Now, that still might be much cheaper than the commission you pay if you do a high-priced property.
Hey, Levitt, here's a question I think you'll like. Actually, kind of two related questions. First one comes from Marvin Young, who is a statistical clerk with the U.S. Census Bureau. He writes, with policies for tough on crime, mandatory minimums, and application checkboxes, I'm curious about the economic impacts of how we rehabilitate felons and some misdemeanor offenders. Levitt, you've thought about this in the past, yes?
Yeah, I sure have thought about that. I mean, these are important and hard questions. Almost everyone who gets sent to prison is going to come out of prison. And it's really tricky to know what to do, both from the perspective of public policy, but also from the perspective of individuals, say people in an HR department who are in charge of doing hiring and deciding, should I hire a convicted felon? And now with the availability of database, it's very easy to find out who's been convicted of various crimes and whatnot. And I think that the evidence suggests that the stigma associated with a conviction at some time in prison for all but the lowest skilled workers is pretty high, pretty costly. The punishment you pay, not just while you're in prison, but in the labor market after you emerge from prison.
And you also, you've argued in the past, I'm curious if this is still your view or whether there's any data that's changed it, that the death penalty as practiced in the United States is wildly ineffective as a deterrent, as a crime deterrent, because it's too distant, takes too long, and just
doesn't happen often enough for it to actually be enough of an at-the-moment deterrent against that kind of crime.
Yeah, if you're a reasonable calculator of costs and benefits, you should not be deterred by the death penalty in the sense that there's something like, 12,000 homicides in the U.S. and there's something like, 20 executed. So your chances of being executed if you commit a homicide are essentially 1 in 1,000, but it comes with a delay usually of 15 or 20 years. And so if you compare it all, the disutility of, life in prison compared to 15 years in prison followed by being executed, and you multiply that by 1/1,000, it just shouldn't matter at all. The likelihood of dying if you're in a drug dealer on the streets is higher than your likelihood of dying if you're on death row, because the streets are dangerous and it's hard to get killed when you're on death row. So I think the death penalty is purely at this point a political beast and not a crime reduction tool.
Here's a related question from Jimmy Derringer, who's a real estate investor in Spokane, Washington. He writes, my question is, if you could do one thing in a city to reduce crime, specifically violent or drug-related crimes, what would that be?
Well, so I'd say Jimmy's asking exactly the right question, that when you're thinking about crime in a city, that crimes that have a lot of costs are the violent crime. And when you say drug-related crime, I think he really means drug-related violence. And I think those are exactly the kinds of crimes that we might be able to have the biggest effect on. I'm not saying the right answer socially would be to do what I'm about to say, but I think in terms of reducing violence, it is by far the single most powerful tool we have, which would be to simply legalize drugs. Especially cocaine, a lot of the violence around in the big cities, at least the ones that I've been in, have been around crack cocaine, cocaine more generally. So I think very effectively and quickly we could dramatically reduce violent crime through the legalization, not just, say, of marijuana, but of all drugs. Now, I think actually that would be a bad idea in general, but I think for solving crime, that to me is an obvious and clear path to some success.
So you say that would be obvious and clear and pretty drastic, right? Like on the spot it would work, but that would be nowhere near as drastic as, for instance, if you change the death penalty, right, and invoke the death penalty for like any violent crime and you execute people pretty much on the spot, kind of Philippine style. And that would, if you want to do one thing to really reduce crime, if the sky is the limit, wouldn't you go more in that direction?
I mean, we could just kill everybody before we start if we want to make sure there's no crime.
Well, there's that. Here's a question that came in, actually kind of two versions of the same question, one from Steve Adema, and one from Miguel Sandoval. One asks, is there a hidden cost to intelligence? I feel a lot of people assume, wrongly, there's a trade-off between intellectual and social ability. And the other fellow asks, can you be too smart for your own good? I've heard this used often. However, I tend to disagree that you can be too smart for your own good. Levitt, you're a relatively smart guy. Have there been instances in your life where you've been too smart for your own good? And do you know anything about this more generally?
I can't say I ever remember being too smart for my own good. I've seen other people. And I'll tell you, the biggest thing that happens in academics is that really smart people become convinced that they can trick not just a single other person, but they can trick everyone at once. I've seen it a number of times where the smarter you are, the more you think you can get away with, and it ends up being your undoing. The people who are really, really smart actually can run circles around people, but it's the people who are one notch below the very smartest who I've seen get into a lot of trouble by thinking they're too smart.
What about the related problem of domain transfer? People thinking that because they're very good or very smart in one arena, they kind of develop an attitude, a confidence that they think, you know, people talk about this with doctors sometimes called the God complex. You think that if you can figure out something like the human body, you can figure out just about anything. Do you see that?
Oh, yeah, that's what we're doing right now. Isn't that where FAQs are? You and I are good at one thing. You know, you're good at writing. I'm good at taking a pile of data and making sense of it. And we sit here and talk like we're good at answering questions about whether we're smart. I mean, it's exactly what we're doing right now. And it's something that you and I rail against all the time. And we have some fun with it just because we know we're among friends on the podcast. But the people listening understand that we're just kind of screwing around when we answer these questions. We're not really giving the truth. Now, if you go back to that first question about the trade-off. Yeah, the social trade-off. I think there are at least two really good reasons to believe that people who are intelligent will not possess particularly good social skills. Okay? And one of those is that if I take just the example of math ability, there's a lot of evidence that autism is a sort of extreme form of mathiness and sort of thinking like a mathematician or like a scientist, and that interferes with the way that you think about people and interact with people. And so I think there's potentially some genetic reasons why being smart in a math way might get in the way of being good with people. I think we've all seen some of that. I think the other thing is just what you invest in, right? So when you're a kid, if you're smart, you invest in the things that smart kids invest in, doing well in school, impressing people, trying to get in college. And if you're not smart, you make a lot of investment in being social and being the cheerleader type or the homecoming king. And those investments are really important.
Excellent. All right. We should sign off. Do you have anything else you want to say?
It's good to be back on doing the FAQs. Let's do that more often.
All right, Levitt. Nice to talk to you. Be well.
Okay, take care.
Bye. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire archive at freakonomics.com or on Stitcher. And on any podcast app, you can always find the most recent 3 months of episodes. Thanks for listening.